Hello. Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Alex DeBoer.
I'm Sammy Smart.
I'm Lyndon Wong.
And I'm Adeline Ping. It's Thursday, October 18th at 5 p.m., we're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's show will start with interviews with two UBC candidates running as independents for Vancouver City Council, Tak Bandal and Abubakar Khan. Tak is currently a PhD student at the Institute of Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice, and Abubakar is a third-year sociology student. We also gathered student perspectives around campus regarding the most important election issues.
Next, we'll feature an interview with David Hendry about Vancouver's tenant union renter report card that was published on October 4th. The published report card grades multiple candidates on how they stand on key renters' issues and was put together by VTU volunteers. The purpose of the renter report card is to increase voter turnout and inform renters about which candidates will best defend their rights as tenants.
Additionally, we spoke with Vancouver's Chief Election Officer, Rosemary Hagawara, in relation to the city's newly expanded mobile voting efforts. For the first time ever, mobile voting took place at the social service centers and homeless shelters, in addition to hospitals and senior care centers. Today's episode will be a continuation of last week's report. Let's take a listen to our UBC candidates piece.
Excuse me, guys. Are you voting in Vancouver's election on Saturday?
I'm not.
No, hey? Are you residents of Vancouver?
We're residents, but I'm an American citizen from Spain.
Oh, okay.
CITR?
Yeah, it's for radio station down there.
So. No, but what is the election for?
Oh, it's for our local government in Vancouver. All the municipalities in BC have elections at the same time, so all the cities.
This past Monday, October 15th, CITR's News Collective spoke with students at UBC's Point Grey campus about Vancouver's 2018 municipal election.
My name's Catherine. I am 21, and I'm in my fourth year.
And do you plan on voting in the election on Saturday?
Yeah, I will be voting.
I'm in my first year.
So it'll be your first time voting?
Yeah, quite excited.
Yeah, I'm Alex. I'm 20.
All right, and have you voted in an election before?
No, this is my first time.
Most of the students we talked to were young, in their late teens or early 20s, meaning this will be their first time voting in a municipal election. We asked them to list some of the issues that mattered most to them.
So what are those issues that are the most important for you in the election?
I guess as a student, like housing, all your income is going to your rent pretty much.
Reducing or like even freezing rent? If there are sustainable ways to do that, which don't damage the economy.
The only one that I've considered as of right now is that I want the rapid transit to extend all the way out to UBC.
The first one that comes to mind for me, and probably the most important, I know for a lot of people as well, would be housing costs and really rental. As a student, it's very difficult really finding a place that is affordable.
While most students didn't yet know who they were going to vote for, affordability and transit were among two of the top issues. But with less than a week until October 20th, we were curious how students plan to get informed fast in this particularly confusing election.
I've just been looking at what clubs on campus, like who they've been advocating for and why. And so I follow like UBC Social Justice Center on social media and stuff, and they do a really good job of talking to candidates. Like for the school board, they're advocating for Diane Day, I think.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of adverts and stuff like that, but I think I'm going to try and go in from an unbiased point of view. So I'm really going to look at all the platforms and really try and see what directly affects our community. I'll probably go on the Vancouver website. I might also consult with like family members and stuff like that, but keep an open mind because they can tend to have their own pre-formed opinions. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
In addition to voting in the 2018 Vancouver municipal election, UBC students are also running for office. Two students, Tak Bandal and Abubakar Khan, are seeking election to Vancouver City Council as independent candidates. We spoke with each of them about why they chose to run in this election and what they're hoping to do for Vancouver if elected to council.
My name is Sukhbir Kaur Bandal in Punjabi and Tak Bandal in Canadian English. and I'm running as an independent for Vancouver City Council.
And what issues inspired you to run for City Council?
Well, obviously affordable housing is the number one issue, I think, on everybody's mind. Also, the report released by the BCCLA, the BC Civil Liberties Association, and the UBCIC, the Union of British Columbian Indian Chiefs, I believe, on police carding of Indigenous and people of color communities by the Vancouver Police Department. That was released earlier this summer, and that was also a big push for me to get involved into municipal politics and to increase the intersectional representation of multiple histories and communities in Vancouver at City Hall.
And why did you choose to run as an independent instead of as a party, especially considering you haven't run for City Council before and there are so many candidates running this year?
Yeah, great question. So as an independent, I can kind of stand on my own two feet. If I'm elected to council, I won't have to vote across party lines, which tends to happen. If you look at the history of motions presented and passed at City Hall. So control over my messaging and my campaign and my decision making was a main driver. And also, I notice when I have been out canvassing that having a political party orientation definitely biases a lot of voters either for you or against you, most of the time against you. So as an independent, I kind of sidestep that bias and get people to listen to my ideas on policy and practice based on my values and principles rather than the history of a political party.
Oh, so you found it to be a great way to develop your own independent voice, especially mm-hmm. since this election focuses on a lot of very pressing issues, I can see, such as affordability, for example, as you mentioned.
Yeah, exactly.
And what message do you have to other UBC students, particularly those who are not exactly sure of why they should care about the municipal election this year?
Yeah, great question. So a few reasons, the first of which is affordable housing. So mm-hmm. I believe that students should only be spending 1/3 of their income on rent. Basement seats can't be the only option for folks close to campus. So I want to increase housing affordability and supply close to UBC campus. So increase the number of non-market rentals, consider what the future of the golf courses and the endowment lands will be, and also support a healthy relationship between the city and UBC. So affordable housing is one. The other is that of the 10 busiest bus routes in the city of Vancouver, 7 of them go to UBC. So I support the SkyTrain to UBC, and I support increasing transit ridership and sustainable forms of transportation to and from campus. And then finally, a lot of students are obviously young folks. We have a really bright future ahead of us. I'm a UBC student myself at the Social Justice Institute. And one pillar of my campaign has been promoting the health of the earth, which is really important for our future. So I'd like to implement feasible municipal policies to contribute to zero waste practices and to support a decrease in dependence on burning carbon. And that's something that UBC has already been showing leadership on. So I'd like to take that model that's happening on campus and bring it to the larger city.
Yeah, these seems like some pretty pressing and important issues. So as you mentioned, like more focus on non-market housing and so sustainable modes of transportation. And so you said you support the new, if there's like a Broadway line being considered, and also sustainable policies being developed, such as shift to like more zero waste actions.
Mm-hmm. Correct?
Yes. And so to finish off, based on your work and life experience so far, why do you think that you're the best candidate to be able to relate to and represent people appropriately in this city?
Mm-hmm, for sure. So I'm a Sikh Punjabi woman of color. If elected, I'll be the first South Asian woman ever elected to Vancouver City Council, despite multiple histories and realities of South Asian and other diverse communities in Canada since the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. So that's one point. And the other is that I've worked in health research and in nonprofits in Canada for the last 7 years. I also work at the soap dispensary and kitchen staples on Main Street, so I'm familiar with the demands and pressures on small businesses. And what I've learned through my through this sharp learning curve in municipal politics is that the role of a councillor at City Hall is essentially the role of a researcher. So every 2 weeks, council is given pretty much a 5-inch thick binder of reports, of policies, of other documents that will help make decisions. And the job of councillors are to work as a team, read through all those documents, and then make informed decisions that support all the communities that live in Vancouver. So my professional and personal experience definitely have prepared me to do that job.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
All right, Abubakar, please give us a little background about yourself.
Well, let's see, where does it begin? So for myself, I was born in the States. My family came here in 1912. I'm fifth generation Canadian. Went to 12 different schools, and that's the biggest thing in my life has always been being uncomfortable and being in different echo chambers, different groups, and connecting them. So I'd say that's the best way to describe myself, a connector.
What inspired you to run for city council?
Honestly, I had no other option. So I did, the thing was, like, I followed that clear-cut route. You know what, how do you go and start making a difference? Go and get in the nonprofit sector, work on charities, go and engage with your local politicians. I sat on youth boards for members of parliament. I sat on youth boards of the city in the Vancouver City Council as well. I'd have coffee with these people. I would work on papers. I did all of that. And after a while, I realized that, you know what, am I just here so that they can tick a box saying that they engage with a millennial? So for myself, it was things weren't changing. So if I just stayed and I kept complaining, or if I just observed, again, I felt that that wasn't the way forward. So that led me to it's time to actually go and run for city council.
So we have a lot of older people that are probably wondering, do you even have enough work-life experience to be able to relate to and represent people appropriately in the city? Are very young.
Yes. So the thing I've also realized as well is that if age is a determining factor in regards to politics, then I guess I'll have to wait 16 years and just watch on the sideline till I'm allowed to go and get into politics. And I think that's a misconception. It's that, you know what, we have to get engaged as soon as possible. So now people that are saying in regards to work-life experiences, I've created 3 nonprofits, I've created 2 charities, I've worked in that sector, I've worked on massive initiatives. We opened the mosque as a homeless shelter in 2016, connected different community groups, connecting different faith groups, connecting different organizations. That's what I do. So again, if it's about experience in regards to how politics has been run, I don't want that experience. I think people are tired of the way politics has been done. So for myself, it's coming out as an outsider, also understanding the system. I understand. I have a lot of friends that are staff at the City Hall as well. So I'm not going in and saying, I'm going to go and change stuff. No, it's being realistic, understanding what I can and cannot do, but also realizing that people don't want to do things the same way anymore. People don't want a politician there that's promising them all of this great stuff. I'm going to end homelessness right away. And, you know, I'm going to make sure you don't have to pay any taxes, and saying this stuff. And once they get into office, there's just no follow-up. So they're over-promising and under-delivering. And so I think that because there's now a lack of trust, and because the current climate has changed immensely, and because millennials are realizing, hey, we have a lot of skin in the game. We're not here for the next 4 years. We're here for the next 40 to 50 years. Because of all of these, I think that's the best way to answer that question.
Why did you choose to run as an independent instead of with a party, especially considering you have not run for city council before and there are so many candidates running this year?
The party system in municipal elections, for me, it just doesn't make much sense. I think, again, parties, they divide rather than unite people. So it's, you know what, you're with this party, I can't work with you. And I think that that bickering is something that we just don't have time for. We have an affordability crisis. We have a mental health crisis. If we're going to be focused on what side of the spectrum you're on, then does that really move us forward? So for myself, as I said earlier, connecting is crucial. So being an independent, I don't have any party ties. I can sit down with Greens. I can sit down with NPA. I can sit down with COPE. It doesn't matter. And I have been doing that. I've connected with all the different parties. So being an independent has allowed me to do that. And also because the campaign finance rules as well, it's much easier to be an independent, right? Now it's tough for parties to raise capital. Also, there's no baggage. I did not do any, but if I was with a party and I had been greenlit by two parties, then I would have to spend most of my time just explaining why they made a decision 10 years ago that I had nothing to do with. So, so because of that, I decided again. Also, people like independence now. They really do. People are tired of the parties. If you look at the recent polls, 50% of people are saying they're going to vote for independence. So that's that shift that's already occurring. The rest of Canada doesn't have party politics in the municipal elections, so I think it's starting to shift now here as well.
All right. What messages do you have to other UBC students, particularly those who are unsure of why they should care about municipal elections?
Honestly, there's not many people that really do vote in municipal elections, right? I think last election, there's 43% voter turnout, which was a lot. The thing is that, you know what, we go, and I remember when Trudeau was running and UBC was just packed, lines all down the stairs, everybody was going to go vote. But what I realized is that federal and provincial politics, they don't really affect your day-to-day life much, if at all. Whereas municipal politics, the running joke is that every time you flush your toilet, you're dealing with your municipal government. So I think that's the thing is that, you know what, you're talking about affordability, which is affecting students. That goes through the municipal government. You're talking about the mental health crisis as well, politics. The municipal government is the one that's a big, it can push a lot of stuff forward. You want funding for a creative project. That's, I mean, your municipal government can help with that. So I think that we have to get engaged with our city. That's crucial. So if we start doing that, we'll start being able to shift things in a positive direction. Provincial and federal, we always go out and vote. It's easier, but we have to get engaged on this level first and foremost. So I say to everybody, just you got to go and vote. You have a lot riding on this, and many people don't exercise that right.
Thank you for your time, Abubakar. This has been a good interview.
Likewise, my man. Pleasure.
Concerts in CITR present Wild Nothing with guests with Men I Trust, Wednesday, October 31st at the Imperial. Tickets are available online and at Red Cat Main Street, Red Cat Hastings Street, and Zulu Records. People are really done with politics as usual.
But then it's all about the competition.
Every Vancouverite has their own story.
The perfect time for our alternative.
Vancouver's municipal election looms, October 20th. Do you know who's running for
City Council, School Board, Parks Board?
This is a wacky municipal election, and you're going to want to stay updated. Download Seeking Office, the newest municipal elections podcast from CITR's News Collective. Find Seeking Office on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever you download your podcasts, starting July 3rd.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Adeline Ping. It's 2 days till BC's municipal elections, so we have some special election coverage on Vancouver and Richmond's municipal elections. You just heard a report from Vancouver on UBC students, what they think are the top elections issues, and which students are actually running for office in the Vancouver election. Next, we'll have an interview with David Hendry from the Vancouver Tenants Union on a renter report card the VTU recently released. This report card ranks parties and independent candidates according to where they stand on issues relevant to tenants.
My name is Logan Turner with CITR's News Collective, and I'm here today with David from the Vancouver Tenants Union. So, David, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and follow up about the renter's report card. Myself and Alex DeBoer were at the VTU's event on September 15th, where you had a diverse group of tenants listen to and rank the responses of some parties and independent mayoral candidates on four topics related to tenants' rights. From those rankings, the VTU created a report card to offer insight into the various platforms and ideas of candidates on how to address housing issues. Is that an accurate reflection of what happened so far on September 15th?
Yeah, that's correct.
Great. And so you guys published the report card on October 4th, and I'm just wondering what has happened since between September 15th and October 4th?
Right. So we went ahead and collected all the scores from the participants who were grading and went ahead and published our report card. And the organizing aspect of that is that we really wanted to use this as a tool for getting out the vote amongst renters in Vancouver. We know that that renters don't vote as much as they should, and that we want to have pro-tenant politicians in city council. And so our plan was to try to reach out into 50 buildings across Vancouver and to have the organizers within each of those buildings going door to door and sharing our report card and then trying to get people out to vote during the voting period.
Great. So, and what has been the general response so far from the public?
Yeah, I think for the most part, when people try to understand the issues, I think a lot of people agree pretty closely with some of the things that we're most interested in. Some of the policies include a rent freeze, having some kind of increased rent control. One of the things that we're advocating for is for basically to have affordability tied to the unit and not to the person, such that when somebody moves out of an apartment, the landlord can't increase the rent up to market. And we believe that, you know, that would have a huge impact on the affordability in the city. Also, we know that rent evictions are one of the biggest aspects. And so when we talk to people about those things, most people can relate to that in terms of their experience. Most renters know that the situation is a crisis. They're the ones that are suffering, and they know that we need really strong policy changes at the municipal level and also the provincial level, and we need advocates in City Hall. So most people, when they hear those kinds of policies, they can relate to it.
And so from these people that you've been talking to, do you think that sharing this report card is going to be effective in getting those renters who you've said tend not to vote in elections? Do you see an impact on increasing the get out to vote then?
I hope so. I think, you know, the majority of people that we've been talking to, so we've been trying to keep some statistics on how many people say yes, how many people say maybe, how many people say no. And the majority of people that we ask, you know, if they will support the findings of the report card, the majority of people say yes. And so I guess it kind of remains to be seen whether we can get those people out into the polls. And today was the first day of early voting, so we'll find out fairly soon whether people are doing early voting or whether they're we're trying to encourage that as much as possible, or if they're waiting more for election day.
Interesting. So going back to how you were saying that most people have said that they agree with the report card, when I was reviewing the report card today, I was shocked to see that Shauna Sylvester, who has introduced many of the very progressive and pro-tenant policies, like making Vancouver the co-op and the co-housing capital of North America, or wanting to raise the vacancy rate to 3%, has an F on your report card. And so I was shocked to see that.
Yeah, and that was somewhat unfortunate because the way that we graded the report card, we did it in a large group of 30 people, and so that wasn't something that we could reproduce. And what happened was we gave her a deadline. We gave everybody a deadline to give their responses, and the majority of the people that did respond responded within a day or two. And Shauna Sylvester did not respond by the deadline. She did send an email apologizing that she wasn't able to get it in on time, but she did not send her responses. And so there's some question about that, whether we should give everybody Fs that that didn't respond in time. But we know that there's a number of the parties didn't respond at all, and we want to reflect that if they didn't respond, we can't give them a passing grade. And so that was our decision for the report card.
Interesting. Okay, just because when reviewing the methodology, I did notice that the email was sent out on September 10th, and then the deadline was September 13th. So that tight-ish deadline, do you think that affected the credibility of the report card at all?
Again, most of the people were able to respond within a day or so,
right.
And we gave them, we emailed them multiple times, and we actually called their offices as well. So we gave them multiple reminders and chances. It's something that we can reflect upon for the next time that we do it. But I was disappointed that she wasn't able to get her answers in on time. I think that she, as well as the other candidate, I would have liked to have seen their responses for these questions.
Right. And so I remember from the September 15th event that the VTU is not using this report card or not trying to ensure that this report card does not reflect an endorsement on a specific candidate. Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's correct. We had a general meeting I remember now a week or so ago, and we did not put any candidates for endorsement by the membership. What we did do was endorse the findings of the report card. So we're the Vancouver Tenants Union in this election is not going to endorse any one party. What we want to do is to try to bring out the pro-tenant progressive vote, and we believe that we want to get progressive politicians on city council so that our housing issues can be heard, and that we have the ability to try to push those policies forward as well. So and we think that we have to work with a number of different parties to be able to do that.
And have most people that you've spoken with understood that it's not an endorsement? Just when you see COPE with all A's and the next group with only B's, it can almost look like it's an endorsement. But have you faced that any sort of perceptions like that at all?
I think that might be a possibility. What we've been telling people as we go door to door is that we're encouraging people to vote for the people that have scored highly,
okay,
in the report card. And so we're pointing to a number of parties, and also COPE is only putting forward a few councillors, only three councillors. And so we want more than that. We want a progressive council in total to form the next council.
Right. And so there's only 10 days left until the end of the election. What are you doing right now? What are you doing to get out the vote?
Right. Well, we have probably about 30 people in different neighborhoods. So quite strongly, I would say, in the West End and Mount Pleasant, Grandview Woodlands, Hastings Sunrise, downtown Eastside, going into their buildings and door knocking and presenting the findings of the report card. And now we're starting to go back into those buildings again and door knock the people that were supportive and trying to really encourage them to get out and vote. So we're letting them know where the closest stations are and really encouraging them that, you know, this election is so important for housing, and it's the number one issue in this election. So tenants should get out and vote, and we need those politicians in place for the next year.
Great. Okay, well, David, thank you so much for having this chat with us, and best of luck with the last 10 days of the election.
Great. Thank you, Logan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You just heard an interview with David Henry of the VTU. He spoke with the News Collective's Logan Turner about the VTU's newly published renter report card. Now we turn to Richmond. The News Collective's Sammy Smart has done a series of interviews with Richmond candidates running for mayoral and council roles.
So, Sammy, you've been talking to some politicians running for office in Richmond.
Yeah, I've talked to incumbent Mayor Malcolm Brody, Judy Schneider, who's running for city council, and Carrie Starchuk, who's also running for city council. And I talked to them about some important election issues. The first issue that we talked about was housing affordability. Malcolm Brody stands by his affordable housing strategy that was implemented before. Let's take a listen.
The best way that we can add to the affordability crisis we have in terms of our housing is through our affordable housing strategy. We've had a very aggressive strategy for over 10 years, and it has resulted in many hundreds of new units coming onto the market through development. And so it would be a matter of expanding that and keeping it going. So, for instance, before, if you had a development of 80 units or more, the developer had to give 5% of the units or a minimum of 5 units for in perpetuity for affordable housing, and would get a density bonus to compensate. So now we move the 5% up to 10%, and the number of units from 80 units down to 60 units. So if you have now have a 60-unit development, then you have to give at least 10% of the units have to be for affordable housing. They're designated that way, and they are kept that way in perpetuity. So that's just one of the ways. You know, part of the issue is very fundamental. People want to live in Richmond. We have very good facilities. We have a good cohesive community, and people want to live here. So if you have a demand for your housing, then prices naturally will go up. Unfortunately, they went up exponentially in the last few years, and so it's led to other issues. But it's not alone. It's gone up, along with every other city in Metro Vancouver.
Interesting. What are the other perspectives like?
Well, Judy Schneider believes that building homes in the downtown core isn't the solution if they're not accessible for families, and that Richmond needs more co-ops and subsidized housing.
We need to hit this on several different fronts. So we need to create co-ops. We need to lobby the provincial and federal governments for co-op housing. We also need subsidized housing, which those two governments can work with the municipal government to get going as well. And we also need to incentivize renovations over demolitions of our single-family homes. A lot of the politicians right now are talking about how, you know, they've built 150 affordable housing units in the downtown core, but they're almost all one-bedroom units. They're not family-friendly, and it's just a dent in the damage that they've done by allowing in 2017 405 single-family homes to be demolished, which were often rental suites or lower-priced starter homes for families just starting out who could renovate them as they had money to and as the need became greater to do so. 405 is the 2017 number, but actually there were over 500 in previous years, just since 2014, since this council has been in charge. So they have done nothing to curb that type of growth, which is killing our rental availability and killing our starter homes.
That's an interesting contrast to Malcolm Brody's view.
Yeah, and on a different side of the same coin, Carrie Starchuk is specifically concerned with short-term rentals and foreign investment in Richmond.
Well, I'd like to address the short-term rentals. So they've done it so that if you're caught operating a short-term rental without a business license, you get $1,000 a day per incident. And I would like to raise that because there is second and third offenders. And so I'd like to make it so uncomfortable that they're not supposed to be operating a short-term rental and not declaring it, is to make it so that they would consider renting their home out to a long-term rental agreement. Mm-hmm. And then I'd also like to see a ban on foreign investment. And Australia, I did an interview with SBS Dateline Australia. They came to Richmond, and I know that you only buy property in Australia if you're a permanent resident. You can buy new property, but you can't buy old. And if you go there and you have a working visa, you can buy property then, but when you leave, you have to sell it. So I'd like to follow what they've done, because we're in a housing crisis. In Richmond, our rental is 0.6.
That's an interesting perspective. Related to that, there's been an issue in Richmond about mansions being built on farmland, right?
Yeah, it's been a really divisive issue. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to talk to anybody on the pro-mansion side, but these three had interesting contributions to the topic. Malcolm Brody is currently the mayor, so he was able to vote on this issue when it came to council.
We took the issue of how big your house could be on the farmland, and we took a very major step and limited it to 1,000 square feet or 1,000 square meters, which is about 10,700 square feet. So that was the first step in the lineup. We reviewed the situation. I felt that it wasn't enough that we had done, even though with the initial cut, put it that way, with that initial regulation, we've significantly reduced the potential size of the homes on the farmland. But I think that the size should be brought back more in line with the provincial guideline, which is 5,300 square feet. And also there should be limitations on the footprint for the house. So in other words, if you have 5,300 square feet, you can't have it all on one floor. You can't have a bungalow with 5,300 square feet. You have to have a two-story house or maybe a two-and-a-half-story house. And so your footprint on the farmland is actually about 3,000 to 3,500 square feet instead of 5,300. So I certainly advocated for those subsequent changes. I was joined by two of the city councilors who agreed. Six councilors did not agree, and so the regulations remain unchanged from the initial reduction.
And the other two had similar opinions. Judy Schneider wanted to enact the provincial guideline legislation for farmland.
People are very, very angry. This is our food security, not just for Richmond, but for the Lower Mainland and in some areas, also for the province. If enough of us are elected who feel similarly, then we will immediately enact a moratorium on applications for mansions on farmland. And then we will enact the provincial guideline legislation, so vote that in, which would actually be lower than the 5,382 square feet maximum house size that is often bandied about. We actually believe in Richard Wozni's report, which stated that the only way to curb speculation on farmland is to have the houses no larger than neighboring residential property maximums, which is between 3,600 and 42,000 square feet as an absolute maximum, or sorry, 4,200 square feet as an absolute maximum.
And Carrie Starchuk actually created a documentary series about this, where she visits some properties and talks to activists about the same issue.
I have a site called Richmond's Changing Neighborhoods. And before I started with the election, we did a documentary on farmland. So if you visit it, there's four clips on farmland. We've listened to the people from FarmWatch, and we've listened to the Farmland Association. And so we've got both sides. So we've got the real estate and the farmers, and then we've got the people that would like to have the land to remain to be farmed. So when we went out and did the documentary, there isn't many villas out on the property that sit empty. And what happened was the real estate, when the 20% on foreign buyers tax, it doesn't apply on farmland. And so the money went to farmland. So we're seeing what people buying property without having to pay the 20% foreign buyers tax. And then what you're seeing is there's these big mega mansions that are being built on farmland, but you got really cheap taxes if you can bring in a crop of $2,500. So I believe that it's being abused. There is farmers that are farmers. That's legit. But what's happened with some of the farmland is being used as real estate investment.
So farmland is a really heated issue then in Richmond?
Yeah, you can definitely see a lot of the big houses on farmland in Richmond when you go through the more rural areas. And like Malcolm Brody said earlier, footprint is a really big issue. Arable land faces potential damage from these houses. And kind of related is cannabis and the issue of where it's going to be grown and sold.
We'll take the retail, the sale side of it, the retail sales side of it, and then we can talk about the cultivation. Mm-hmm. Our council, again, almost unanimously, has said that we don't want retail shops selling cannabis in our city. We can't change the laws that allow possession, but what we can do is we can say, well, you're going to get your cannabis somewhere else. Probably the strongest motivator, at least from my point of view, is what happened in Vancouver, where they ignored the issue of the medical marijuana dispensaries only to end up with hundreds of them. Like almost every city block, commercial block, has a marijuana dispensary. And so the answer is no, we don't want that. And I think there's been strong public support for that position. In terms of the cultivation, we have yet to actually consider what we think about growing it in the ground. I personally don't have any objection if a farmer, instead of planting potatoes, wants to plant cannabis. I don't have any particular objection to that. Where the problem comes in is with respect to having enclosed areas, greenhouses, where they grow cannabis. And so what we have done is we have taken the position that we will prohibit greenhouses being built with concrete floors and certain kinds of concrete construction. The idea being that once you construct a greenhouse with a concrete floor, then it's not going to be able to be ever used for the soil-based farming, and we want to preserve the land for the soil-based farming. So that has been our position. We have said that if you want to grow cannabis inside a building, grow it in an industrial area because we think that it's an industrial use of property. But if, you know, do not grow it in these big greenhouses on agricultural land. Take it somewhere else.
So he has concerns about the use of land after the fact. What are the other viewpoints on cannabis in Richmond?
Well, Judy Schneider talked to me about regulating it and how it should work kind of like how private liquor stores work.
We, well, personally and our slate feels that we need to follow the same guidelines that liquor distribution centers follow. They cannot be within a certain area near a school or a park, and they have to be spread out. You can't just have, you know, three in a row. And I believe that will help allay a lot of the people's fears of creating neighborhoods where that is the prominent business and spread the businesses out. It is becoming legal. It's becoming legal for a reason, and it should be treated the same as alcohol.
And Carrie Starchuk wants to see how it can be sold similarly to liquor as well.
Well, I must say that I am not a fan of marijuana. Period. I've never done it. I don't plan to do it, but that's my own opinion. Justin Trudeau is going to legalize marijuana on the 17th of this month. There's no going back. We have to look to the future and see how it can be sold like liquor was sold. But we must be very cautious that it doesn't harm the young people and the young minds.
So they really want to make sure it's regulated in Richmond, is that correct?
Yeah, it seems like across the board, candidates are for really strict regulation. Often cited as the issue in Vancouver, where there's multiple dispensaries in one block. They really don't like that model.
So after doing all these interviews, what have you taken away?
Well, I've taken away that these issues are very confusing to people in and out of Richmond, especially outside of Richmond, because they're so hyper-local. And these issues are very divisive. People are very angry about a lot of these issues, especially the farmland issue. It's been heated for months. And it's sometimes very hard to get the other side of these things. A lot of candidates are more available to talk than others. So as much as I would love to have had more viewpoints, it's honestly impossible sometimes.
All right. Well, thanks for your reporting. This has been great.
Thank you.
Stay tuned to CITR 101.9 FM. We'll now turn to some ads, but we'll be right back.
Let's see here. God. Oh. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Oh. Everybody.
God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything?
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 Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Welcome back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. It's 2 days till the elections, and you're listening to our special coverage on the upcoming Vancouver and Richmond elections. You've just heard several interviews with multiple Richmond candidates regarding different issues regarding the upcoming election. Now we turn to our final piece on our show, mobile voting in Vancouver's 2018 election.
Hello, my name is Samuel Jones. Last show we talked about how mobile voting. Me and Lyndon Wong had ventured out to two locations in the west and south end of the city. After checking those out, me and Alex DeVore decided to visit the east end of the city to check out the mobile voting centers there. The first one we went to was Atira, a women's center just spitting distance from Oppenheimer Park. But first, for some background on what mobile voting is and how it works, we'll listen to Alex's conversation with Rosemary Haguara on how they've changed.
Would you mind just saying your name and your role with the Vancouver municipal election?
Rosemary Haguara, Chief Election Officer.
Awesome. Could you start out by talking a bit about the amended bylaw, which allows for mobile voting centers now to be brought to homeless centers and social service centers? For example, how did you decide which centers would be locations for mobile voting?
So the bylaw amendment went through in May, and that was based on research done by staff looking at what's the pattern down in it, especially in the downtown east side. We heard from 2014 that the voters down there were not participating in the election. So we wanted the opportunity to bring voting to them. And what we found through the research was that the residents in the area are more comfortable voting in their environment. They're familiar with the environment. So we've been working with the shelters, the administrators at the shelters and social service agencies, and just come up with a schedule, what works for them. What we've decided on was the high traffic time. So the schedule now is available on our website, and people can look at the times where we're there. We're actually servicing 32 locations over the period from October 9th to the 19th. And we're hoping that a lot of the residents will be able to attend at one of the facilities.
So mobile voting initially started out to give better access to voting to people with physical disabilities, or physical barriers, rather. And now it's expanded to people with, you know, mental health barriers or drug addiction barriers. Do you see this expanding even further to other marginalized groups?
We like to see what happens with the pilot after this election, and we'll have a debrief with the administrators in the centers and some of the activists in the area. We want their feedback as well. Yes, you're correct. The bylaw used to allow just for mobile voting at long-term care facilities and hospitals only. So we're very, very excited that we're able to expand to more facilities, and the response has been really phenomenal. So we're excited to get this going for them. And then, you know, again, we always do a debrief after the election to see what else we can improve on. The theme this time is we're bringing voting to the voters. So we're hoping that either we expand the program or they're happy with what we're providing, we'll continue on.
So it definitely seems like there's been a large effort towards reaching out to many different groups compared to before. So we reported on mobile voting on the east end side on last week's report. So how are the mobile voting centers in the east end Vancouver area compared to the centers in the west end?
Well, me and you, Lyndon, visited the mobile sites that have been run traditionally as opposed to the new ones popping up in social service centers such as Atira. The difference mainly is the targeted groups. Mobile voting sites now have been extended to not just those with physical barriers, but also more social ones. A big part of it is making sure marginalized people can vote in a space they are comfortable in. For more on that, we're going to go to Sandra, the head election official for the Mobile Voting Center at Atira.
Hi, I'm Sandra Bowl, and I am the presiding election official for the on October the 13th for the day. And we're casting ballots, or helping folks cast ballots that are marginalized. And we're out in the community trying to reach them in their communities where they feel safe.
Could you tell us where we are right now?
We're at Atira, and it's a project that helps marginalized women.
And so I think this voting site was open from 11 to 2. So you've been here over that span. Would you mind telling us roughly how many people have used the voting site?
Yeah, there's only been about a half a dozen people that have come in. We're hoping a bit more. It's a Saturday morning, sunny out, and so maybe, you know, the people have other things to do. But we are in the downtown east side right up until the 19th, and we'll be at a variety of different sites, so people can come to a lot of different centers. They just have to sort of look them up in the Elections BC website.
Besides, like, looking up where the sites are, has there been outreach done that you're aware of specific to the different voting locations? So for example, at Atira, did maybe the people who run it reach out to their members via email or in person, or do you have any understanding of how communication like that unfolded?
I think it started probably almost probably a year ago before the election, where city officials came out and targeted different nonprofits to get them to see if this would be an appropriate venue for people to come and vote. I know that lady, the coordinator here, because they have many different sites, residencies, they have gone out to the individuals that live in these residencies to encourage them to come to us and vote. We also have given them lots of notice to advise them when we were coming to do this voting, and we'll come over many days, so it's a couple of hours here, a couple of hours another time. So you're trying to reach people so that they can feel comfortable, right, and voting in with the vote.
So basically the city gives a lot of notice and lets sites or organizations know that they're coming, and then it's sort of up to that organization to disseminate the voting information, like the dates.
Yes, that's correct. And we give them lots of information. There's a guidebook, there's other pamphlets, brochures that we give them, posters, so that they can put them up in different sites. We try to advertise as much as we can. I think some of the radio stations advise people that there is this special voting going on. Also, advance polls are taking place as well at some of the different community centers and organizations. So
excellent.
Hopefully people will get out.
I hope so too. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hope that helped.
So it seems like outside of accessibility and accessing the community at whole, there's also been currently a lot of focus on the issue of awareness regarding the municipal election. So can you elaborate on how Atira has worked with mobile voting to increase visibility and turnout?
Well, actually, we spoke to Atira's head, Nikki, about that, so we'll go to her right now.
So, I'm Nikki Antonopoulou. I'm the Executive Director of Operations with Atira. And when we always wanted to provide opportunities to women so they get the chance to vote, and we had the shelter vacant, and because we have a number of programs around, we thought it would be the best space for women to have a safe place to vote.
Awesome. I'm just wondering how you told the women who use Atira about this voting opportunity. Is it in person? Was it over email?
It was in person. I forward all the information to our different programs to the staff, and then the staff had conversations with women about the voting, and we posted the posters and the location and time for the voting and all of the programs.
Okay, yeah. Cool. And over what span of time roughly would you say that was?
We started actually probably middle of September, maybe. Yeah, middle of September, and then the last email was sent this morning just to remind the women about the vote, and the posters were sent about 2 weeks ago, and again this week.
And are you happy with the turnout, or how has the turnout been today?
Even one woman was able to vote, I would be happy. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
So it definitely seems like voter turnout has been pretty positive for some areas like Atira. So regarding the whole mobile voting centers as a whole, what do you think the municipal government should work towards to improve accessibility and the voting process overall? And how effective do you think mobile voting has been?
So the station at UBC's hospital was scarcely attended. The station happening across the city at the CarePoint Senior Center was, however, very useful for residents and was certainly utilized. Downtown, when it came to social service centers, Atira, you know, while slow, gave women with barriers before them a chance to vote normally and to do so in a safe environment that they felt comfortable in. While the Gathering Place Community Center station may have been ultimately redundant, I'm referencing another community center across the city, sort of by South Granville. That one would have been a voting in a place to vote anyways at the 20th. What I was told personally about Oppenheimer Park having about 30 people voting really solidifies to me that these are working, that these are giving people a chance to vote who normally would not have done so. As far as what they can do to improve, you got to get the message out there. And I think they've been trying to do that in fairness to them. So while the perceived effectiveness of mobile voting stations isn't always clear and isn't always consistent, I think they've been doing democracy in Vancouver a huge favor.
Yeah, well, it seems like mobile voting has definitely had an interesting start, you know. Maybe it's pretty good in terms of accessibility, but maybe in terms of turnout and awareness, definitely something to improve on. Well, thanks for your report, Sam. It's been very insightful and a very good deep dive into the world of mobile voting.
You're very welcome, Lyndon.
All right. Thank you very much to both of you. My name is Alex DeBoer, and this is the end of Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Remember to get out and vote this Saturday, October 20th, as well after you cast your ballot at one of the many polling locations across our city. You can just Google which one is closest to you. Head out to the Lido, located on Broadway and Fraser, for Seeking Office's election night party. We're going to be streaming the results. We're going to be doing some local politics trivia. There'll be a few prizes. We'll have some drinks. It'll be great. So come on out. And that's it for now for Democracy Watch. Continue listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Up next is Alec Christensen, Flashback with Alec Christensen. So enjoy.